What's up, Foos? Main event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Gabriel Hesch from the Breaking Math Podcast. I am thrilled to announce that we have teamed up with a particle physicist and a science fiction author named Dr. Alex Alaniz to create a brand new science show on YouTube. Our new show is called the Turing Rabbit Holes Podcast. It's named after the mathematician and father of modern computer science, Alan Turing. You can find us at youtube.com/Turing Rabbit Holes Podcast, and that's spelled T-U-R-I-N-G, Rabbit Holes Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe for great visual storytelling about the history of mathematics, physics, and computer science and the impact that they have had on society. Again, that's youtube.com/Turing Rabbit Holes Podcast. And now, back to the Breaking Math Podcast.
This episode is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 International License. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
Somebody stole our website!
Oh no! Whatever shall we do?
I mean, I guess you could go to the new website, http://breakingmathpodcast.app, with no www for all you old-timers.
So breakingmathpodcast.app? I mean, if you're into that sort of thing.
Hey, Breaking Math fans. First, I want to thank you for listening. I have an important message for everyone. You can start your own podcast right now with Anchor. Anchor lets you create and distribute your own podcast. Just get an idea, record, and upload. It's just that easy. Anyone can do it. I'm on my way to accomplishing my dream, and you can too. Just get on your device's app store and download Anchor. It contains everything you need to make a podcast. With Anchor, you can put your podcast on all the big platforms. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon, and more. Reach the whole world with Anchor. Best of all, Anchor is free. You have nothing to lose with a free platform. Download the Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Machines have been used to simplify labor since time immemorial and simplify thought in the last few hundred years. We're at a point now where we have the electronic computer to aid us in our endeavor because it allows us to build hypothetical thinking machines by simply writing their blueprints, namely the code that represents their function, in a general way that can be easily reproduced by others. This has given rise to an astonishing array of techniques used to process data, and in recent years, much focus has been given to methods that are used to answer questions where the question or answer is not always black and white. So what is machine learning? What problems can it be used to solve? And what strategies are used in developing novel approaches to machine learning problems? All of this and more on this episode of Breaking Math, episode 49, Thinking Machines 2. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Gabriel.
And you're listening to Breaking Math. Now, we have a few plugs. The plugs, let's just say about COVID-19, as always, stay safe, wear masks and social distance.
That's right. We're wearing a mask right now as we're doing this podcast. That way we won't, you know, pass our germs on to you or something.
Yeah, germs can be spread through the radio. But no, just kidding. But seriously, like,
we're going to have somebody roast us for that. We're just kidding.
Oh, I know, right?
Yeah,
they just stopped
kidding.
Listening to the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just stopped listening.
They're going to write an angry Facebook post.
We are wearing masks on this podcast in solidarity with you. How's that?
These rules might seem silly to some people because some people have said, how does the virus know the difference between a grocery store and a restaurant? And the answer is it doesn't, but the less you go out, the less the virus has a chance to spread. So that's why it's limited to certain things. I mean, they had to choose certain things, you know, and restaurants are high risk because you're in a enclosed space for like an hour with a bunch of people who are chewing and wiping their spit. And yeah, it's a high germ environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. In fact, the grocery stores that I've seen have been doing a fantastic job of limiting the amount of people who go in at any given time. And they also have somebody constantly wiping off the carts in between each use. That is outstanding. That is a great way of clearing off any germs. Not to mention everybody has their masks on. And in a restaurant, you wouldn't always have your mask on. There's just more probability. So nonetheless.
Yeah. And not to be a Debbie Downer, but I just want to remind everybody listening that that this is only wave one of the pandemic. There's never been a recorded pandemic in history, not the 1919 flu, not the the plagues, not bouts of typhus and cholera. They always have a second wave that is more deadly than the first. So I just thought I'd bring that up because it's a harsh reality.
Absolutely. So better safe than sorry.
But yeah, so because of COVID, episodes 1 through 10 and the Black Hole series, The Abyss, Into the Abyss, and Gaze Into the Abyss, and the comedy that we made after that, have no ads during this time.
Yay, no ads, because we all know how much we love ads. That's our gift to you. No ads at all on those episodes. Those were a lot of fun. Black holes have been probably my single biggest fascination for the last 15 years. So that was a lot of fun. Sophia wrote the sketch, and I may or may not have inspired it in some parts, I don't know, but it's almost a sci-fi Monty Python-esque sketch, and we have it on our podcast. It is called Black Hole Heist. It's just pure silliness. After the deep dive research into black holes, we felt like our brain needed a break, so we decided to write a funny sketch for your enjoyment.
Yeah, I mean, I'll play a few seconds of it now.
The entrances and exits into and out of Tokyo have all been devoured, and all that remains is a moat of lava. Time to kick some butt.
How are you going to attack Nadia?
Rocket launcher. I swear you're just so forgetful. We talked about this like 5 minutes ago.
That won't work. She just absorbs it and grows stronger.
I'm General Specific. And I'll say how we attack this thing. Soldiers, fire the big guns!
Sir, please, you're just making her angry.
I'll tell you something, kid. I've been a general for 40-odd years, and in that time, I can proudly say that I have never negotiated with space-time anomalies.
She's not an anomaly. She's a black hole found throughout the universe.
The sound changed. Was that sound supposed to be the hum of the black hole or the containment field? I'm confused.
And we also have a Patreon poster tier. We have Patreon. You could donate $1... and get, mention on the show if you want. Nobody's taking us up on an offer. For $5, we put up the shows without ads and outlines that we used for the episodes on Patreon. And we're pretty good about that lately. And we also have a poster tier, $22.46, I believe. where we will send you one of our posters. If you don't want to pay monthly because you just want a poster, we have our Facebook poster store at facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast and just click on store. It is E to the E dollars or $15.15 for a tester poster plus $4.50 shipping and handling, which we've been able to get down significantly on both of those things, meaning that it's only $19.65 for a poster. It's very big. It's like 36 inches by 24 inches. It has a great deal of explanation of tensors, which are imperative to explaining Einstein's theory of general relativity, because otherwise it would be something like 80 or 160, I can't remember, differential equations.
Yeah, that poster is amazing. So that's available on the website, on the Facebook Marketplace, as well as on Patreon. So real quick, just a note. I think you'll notice that there are some blips on my sound wave because my son has been outside banging on the door. It's not super loud.
Oh, yeah. And honestly, like, I don't think that it'll matter too much. Like, I mean, we're during a pandemic, whatever, you know, like... And he didn't sound like he was like dying or anything. He just sounded like he was like, hey, I'm a baby. I need attention. I need something, you know?
Yeah, we were on the Twitter and Facebook part where we have all of our updates, you know, including at Breaking Math Pod for the Twitter handle. And then our Facebook page is just facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast.
Oh, yeah. And we have the website at breakingmathpodcast.app. Pirate stole our other one. We're very sad about it, but we've moved on to greener and appier pastures. So it's breakingmathpodcast.app. Just don't put www.
Yeah, that's, yes. Yeah, no www. http://breakingmathpodcast.app.
Or just breakingmathpodcast.app without the http.
Even that works.
No www.
I'm old school. Alrighty, so this episode will be an interesting one. This is a follow-up to our last episode, in fact. This is more about what we can do with machines, what neat things we can do with machine learning and thinking and communicating. Because although there have not been any attempts, you know, since the time of Leibniz to seriously make a universal alphabet, in fact, we still hold the position that such a thing is not possible, we certainly have gotten machines to get better at learning and teaching themselves things. And that's what this episode is all about. Categorization. Also, extraction of features from data. That sounds surgical. And trained.
But yeah, I mean, it is kind of surgical because, like, you know, these are the kind of problems like, you know, like, you know, you have a picture of like a bunch of like, you know, dogs in a meadow. And it's like outline all the dogs, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's something that can be done by neural networks now.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I have not read, I shouldn't say this. I was going to say, I have not read the latest, but then why am I podcasting about it? So,
I mean, you read it like a bunch of the stuff on the, we at Breaking Math maintain the position that without perfect knowledge of a subject, you shouldn't ever even be talking about it. You should keep your head down in the ashes and you should drag yourself in the streets by your knees.
Yes. Don't even open your mouth. That's why we know everything about every topic we've mentioned, right? No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yeah. We've never made a mistake on this show.
Of course not. So in this episode, we'll be talking a lot about Markov chains, about what they are, where they came from, what they're currently used for. Also, something called LSTM. How would you describe LSTM for an audience?
LSTM is they're a type of neural network neuron that can be used for things like sequences. So, for example, if you're trying to get a neural network to compress HTTP, you can use an LSTM. Or if you want to get a neural network to try to generate music based on some samples of music, an LSTM might be the way to go. And as we'll see, it's used because it has the ability to forget information in specific ways.
Interesting. Yeah. Intentionally forgetting. What a concept. Yeah. And there's many, many variants on that. In fact, that section alone on our outline, I think, is about 3 pages here. Is that what I'm seeing?
Oh, it's like 2 pages.
Okay. Well, okay. I sometimes stretch the truth. Yep. And then we also are going to talk about properties and probabilities of random variables and Bayes' theorem and Bayesian networks and how probabilities are used in machine learning. So quite a hefty episode today.
Oh, yeah. And then we'll talk a little about the future of this type of research.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I'd love to hear from some folks out there who are working in neural networks to hear some of the cool things that they've been up to.
So as we dive into the more nitty-gritty aspects of this episode, we are going to start with something called LSTM, which I did not know before doing the research for this episode. Any guesses on what LSTM stands for? No spoilers. LSTM stands for long short-term memory. I'll say that again. Long short-term memory. Sophia, care to elaborate on what long short-term memory is?
Yeah, basically LSTMs are cool for is with a normal neural network, if you want to connect the neural network to itself, you know, so it's in a loop, using normal backpropagation, which is used to train neural networks. It's kind of like you can think about it, the algorithm that is used for learning.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track, and I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
You get these like divided by zero and like weird answers with that, because basically the error as you go in a circle keeps propagating so much that goes into infinity. Mm-hmm. So a long short-term network is a modification of this type of neuron, that where each neuron has what's called a forget vector that tells it what parts of what information to forget or to not like factor into the output. So basically it could have a short-term memory because, like, you know, the forget vector is strong or long-term. I believe that's why it's called long short-term memory. I haven't looked that up actually very hard, but that's what's cool about it is that it could be used for like, recurrent neural networks.
Interesting. Now, real quick, you said a few things in that description, and I'd like to, real quickly, for somebody who is not familiar with how neural networks work, how would you explain the bare bones basics of how a neural network itself works? You had said some terminologies here. I think we've said in a previous episode on called Artificial Thought, but just for the sake of review, how would you describe, backpropagation?
Well, basically, the way that a neural network works is that you have all these inputs, and as they go forward, they're added together, like the ones that are connected together are added together, and they're added together and put through a function that's called a sigmoid function, usually, that goes from -1 to 1 as x goes from negative infinity to infinity. So basically, like -1,000 would be like -0.999 or something, 0 would be 0, and 1,000 would be like 0.999, and like, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And what's cool about that, though, is that for some reason, that's not totally well understood. I mean, it is understood and it's getting better understood, and there's some papers on computational geometry that deal with this.
Nice.
And also just neural networks, but like you're able to approximate functions using these. And the problem with in backpropagation, what that is that you see how much error there is in your approximation by judging it based on some criteria, and it could be any criteria, it could even be human criteria. You go back in time, basically, and say, okay, so based on like this, and it's based in calculus because these neurons have very simple functions. And you go back in time and say, okay, this neuron is responsible for this much error. So that means we have to change it this much. Like, you know, it's like a perturbation.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. There's quite a bit there. That's quite a mouthful. So it sounds like it not being completely understood, it's a little bit of a black box, sort of a, the analogy I use is in terms of understanding it, like tangled Christmas lights. Like it works, you plug it in, it lights up, but you can't really quite see where everything is going and how exactly it works. But we're, again, as you said, we're getting better at that. So,
yeah. And that's a type of research that, you know, is ongoing is how to make sense of neural network solutions, you know?
Yes. What's funny is on my end, I know that there is a sound of a baby crying and baby knocking, and on your end, there's a cat meowing. It'd be funny if at this entire episode we have like random sound effects that are in the background. Like, who even knows?
Oh, yeah. Let me let that cat out real quick one second.
Okay.
Yeah, in this episode, it'd be funny if you had, like, you know, ice cream truck sounds and then, like, explosions, machine guns, and, like, other random background sounds. Like, everyone's like, what? Sorry, guys. Working from home. Yep, working from home.
Carnival music.
You know, banging on pots and pans. Yeah. Anyway, so that is the single thing I heard from your description of neural networks more than anything else was the cat meow. No, I'm just kidding. So, yeah, they are quite interesting. And then when you get to LSTM, as we said earlier, the thing is you have the ability to forget and how that's utilized in machine learning. Now, I think there's some equations that we have in this episode that we're going to talk about. We're not going to bore you to tears with them, but we have some important variables to talk about. One of the variables.
Yeah, and we're not going to read the equations out. We're going to talk about what the equations do, but we will talk about the variables that are involved.
Yeah, probably worth it to just go, yeah, just to discuss, as you said earlier, just to discuss the variables, even if we're not going to, you know, hit you over the head with the equation itself, because we know that that's what you all came here for, right? You know, just to read you equations. Okay, so one of the most popular variables in all physics and math is the letter C. This equation is brought to you by the letter C. You want to explain what C stands for with LSTM?
C is just an activation vector, which is a fancy name for, hey, it's a little piece of information that helps it do its job. And it's also the output. Like C, it's not the output, but it is, it might be the output. Yeah, it's used heavily in the output.
C is the activation vector. When you say that, it just sounds high tech. You know what I mean? Like, I just imagine these machine sound effects like, you know, C is the activation vector. It's like, so for the cell state.
And the reason why it's a vector is because these are solutions that have a lot of like information on them, you know, okay. Like, for example, like, you know, generating like, you know, text or something like that. And so you have an input and an output vector as well. And you have a forget vector. And what's cool about all these vectors is that they all have weights on them that tell them how to connect to one another. And they all at their base are connected to these vectors X and H, which are the hidden vector. And just this other vector that is, just used in calculation. And what it turns out to be is something that can forget, because the gates that is used in output, the forget vector is the higher the forget vector is, the less that this neuron cares about its previous state. So like I remember these neurons are used for generating sequences. So that's why they care so much about their previous state sometimes. But other times when it doesn't matter and it would cause a huge backpropagation error, it turns out the forget gate allows that to nip it in the bud.
Wow, interesting. You know what else I'd like to do real quick? As we're getting more into the technical details of these different neural networks, I want to take a moment and explain what kind of why neural networks? What kind of problems are we trying to solve with neural networks? I know we've gotten into the how. But again, just to provide a little more context here, why? So with LSTM, but as well as neural networks in general, can we, and I realize this may be appropriate earlier in the episode, but we'll just do it now just because. What are some problems that neural networks are being used to solve?
Well, I mean, what they could be, with an early project that a lot of people learn when they're doing a neural network is they develop a neural network that can identify written digits, which surprisingly only takes 20 minutes to write using Python if you know what you're doing. Like, if you know what you really know what you're doing, it only takes 2 or 3 minutes. You could, there's also a website, thispersondoesnotexist.com. Gabriel, have you gone to that?
No, I've never gone to this person does not
exist. Go there real quick.
Okay. This person does not exist. Oh, we're in for some excitement here. Oh my gosh. Okay. It's a picture of a dude. He's smiling.
Yeah, he doesn't exist. It's generated by a neural network.
Wow, that is insane.
Yeah, you know, keep refreshing it.
Is it possible to have competing neural networks where you have one of them outputting these pictures of people who don't exist and someone else trying to identify real from fake? I only bring this up.
That's literally, it's funny that you're bringing that up because that's literally how that works. It's called a generative adversarial network. And you have one neural network that is trying to fool the other one, and the other one is trying to outthink the other one. And together they start generating data based on sometimes very small sample sizes.
Nutty. This is insane. I mean, now I'm thinking of okay, fine. How many neural networks could you have in on this? Is it a huge gang fight? You know what I mean? And would it be possible to I mean, is this just something where it just gets closer and closer to approximating perfection, where it's not, you just can't tell? Or once you figure out a way to tell, then pretty soon the way this production works, that issue that you've discovered will be taken care of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and also, like, anybody can play around with deepfake now. Wow. Like, deepfake, you can make videos of, just take, videos of world leaders, and you can put your face on them if you just, like, take a video of you for a few minutes talking.
Oh,
like, it's really cool. I mean, there's also deep voice, which is the same thing with voice.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, it's really cool, the kind of stuff that we're doing with neural networks now. Like, The potential is barely scratched the surface.
Fascinating. Okay, so again, yeah, just going to thispersondoesnotexist.com, it's these pictures of these people. It looks like real people. This is just wild. You know, and throughout the production of the Breaking Math podcast, there have been several opportune times that I've sought after to look for times to bring up the show Rick and Morty. I know it's a comedy show. A lot of folks who I bring this up, a fair amount of folks see it as rather juvenile. Nonetheless, Rick and Morty has some very, very deep scientific and philosophical ideas, and one of them relates to this website I'm looking at right now, thispersondoesnotexist.com, as well as the power of neural networks in problem solving and even in creation. And it's funny, I just mentioned creation. This is similar to, in our previous episode, Gottfried Leibniz imagined an alphabet, a perfect alphabet that through basic combinatorics or, you know, complex combinatorics could come up with any knowledge or any creation. Well, that can't be done, but we do here have a process rather than, you know, an alphabet per se, a process that it is not perfect, but it is astonishing nonetheless, a process of competing neural networks that is able to produce things that have never existed before. So tell me, is what I'm looking at right in front of me, is this digitized? Is this automated creativity? Isn't it?
I would say that, I'm not sure it's automated creativity or if it's automated expression of the creator's creativity. Like the question is, like, when does a program get like complex enough that you could call it its own creativity?
Yes.
And I would say that point happens when the machine can defend its own creation.
Fair enough. And we wouldn't, maybe the machine would consider something art and we would not consider it art. I'm still going to come around to the Rick and Morty piece here. I just need to get all of these things out because, you know, I'm thinking of them as we go. You had mentioned that this website, which is working based on two or more competing neural networks. I believe it's two in this case.
Okay. Yeah.
Where it creates these faces that don't actually exist. So this might be an expression of the original creator's creativity, kind of like how, you know what an addle-addle is, where somebody would use an addle-addle to increase their throwing, where the human being is still doing the throwing, but the addle-addle adds a whole lot more power to the throw.
Addle-addle is like if you've ever seen Hialeah, it's just kind of like this big it's like this long stick with a hook at the end that you train to put a spear kind of in or bounce it against and throw it extremely quickly.
So these neural networks, although they themselves are not automating creativity per se, they are certainly contributing to the original author's creativity, perhaps. Like an addle-addle would, you know, increase a human's throw power. Is that a fair analogy?
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, and I'd also say, like, our whole definition of creativity is based in a world that did not account for this kind of thing. So maybe we're going to have to come up with new words and stuff to describe human artistic experience.
You're exactly right. And one of the issues with recognizing artificial intelligence, or one of the issues with recognizing other intelligence at all, whether, you know, it's from octopi or other things, is that our recognition of intelligence is what we consider intelligent. That is to say, it's culture and context dependent. So much of it is based on our own, you know, our own culture and our own context. Not all the time, but so much of it is. You know, the example I have here is in a recent article this last year, it was shown that fish, I don't remember which fish, I'm going to have to find this article, but there are some fish that were thought to be emotionless, that were discovered to have complex emotions that we just don't recognize because of facial expressions. Their faces
A freaky video of an eel being pet by a scuba diver, and it was cuddling like it was like a dog.
Yeah, I saw
and
that.
And not only that, there's an experiment done recently with octopuses that where they gave them MDMA, methylene deoxymethamphetamine, which is also known as ecstasy in its pill-pressed form, or Molly in its street crystallized form.
Can you imagine? Wow. Imagine being
an empathogen in humans. But have you heard about this experiment?
Oh, yes, I have, and I haven't read more about it. And I'm imagining...
Yeah.
Wow.
Basically, what's weird about it is that octopus don't even have a pleasure reward pathway. Their brain is structured fundamentally different than the way that human brains are. But for some reason, they had the exact same qualitative experiences that humans do on MDMA, like a tactile sensitivity, increased social ability, like playfulness, things like that.
Wow, that's crazy. I was gonna say, could you imagine being on the committee that evaluated this test? Whoa.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Oh, these guys want to what? They want to give octopuses drugs?
Oh yeah, I mean, I will advocate right now though for MDMA. It was used in the 1980s by a lot of psychotherapists for a while in an increasing fashion until it was scheduled by the government because of its perceived association with subcultures. Basically, people were partying with it and people considered it dangerous. But honestly, like it's a miracle drug for PTSD when used in a clinical setting.
I've heard.
I mean, I could also advocate for ketamine and psilocybin, not to mention cannabis. There's a lot of substances that have been, unfortunately, because they have a strong effect and because they're a kind of new science, we have done a very human thing and we have become scared of them and we've locked them away in a cabinet.
Yes. Yeah. So I've heard. Wow. Fascinating. Now, remind me the acronym that you used for the drugs that were given to the octopi.
MDMA. Yeah.
MDMA. What is that commonly known as? Is something else?
Ecstasy.
Okay. Got it. Wow, that's fascinating. And also, I had no idea that their pleasure pathways are different than ours.
Yeah, they literally don't have the same because they have a donut-shaped brain. So the entire way that their brain works from the ground up is different. How these molecules created the same response they didn't expect anything like that. It's actually one of the most mysterious experiments that I've read about in my lifetime.
As I was saying earlier, this is all going to come around full circle. And I had mentioned Rick and Morty for a reason. The first thing I wanted to say is that recognizing intelligence might be a difficult thing to do. Now, you can do it when you have problem-solving abilities, but expressions of culture, they might be so alien to us that what is a vibrant culture and a real culture, we think is just noise or barbarism. You know what I mean?
I've always thought of that as a fundamental flaw with the traditional Turing experiment. For those unfamiliar, the Turing test is you get a computer and you connect it to a human in a way that the human can't tell if it's a computer or a human being.
Yeah.
And then you have them talk to it for a while and guess whether or not it's a human being. And if it can fool most human beings, then it has passed the Turing test and is considered by this test conscious. And while it has a lot of benefits, I can see this test being used against artificial intelligence beings after that, because I mean, in the United States, there's so many different cultures. There's a culture in the Northeast. There's, I mean, there's even ethnic subcultures. There's Black people. There's Irish people, Hispanic people. There's some people in like Minnesota with a very strong German culture, and all these people will have little cultural tells. Like, I don't think it's very likely that artificial intelligences wouldn't develop their own probably bizarre culture.
Yeah.
So within probably a couple of years of these artificial intelligences being able to interact with one another, people would be able to tell via cultural signals that they were not a human. And they might use that as saying like, oh, see, then they're not conscious because I could tell they're not a human. And I could see that being used by artificial intelligence bigots.
That's scary. Yeah. And again, we've talked a very, very common thing on this theme on this podcast. And by the way, those who are waiting for my Rick and Morty thing, it's coming. It's coming. Trust me, it all relates to this. But a common thing that we talk about is Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And, you know, that talks about how mathematics is always incomplete and you will always have axioms that you can't prove are true.
Theorems that you can't prove are true using the axioms.
Yes. And what I'm talking about with not being able to tell if a culture is, again, we're quick to identify a culture that is not our own as barbarism when it might not actually be. It might be a valid culture that we just don't recognize. You know what I mean? Like, again, there's nuance, and there are things that you just can't know at first glance until you have much more information. And even then you'll never know for sure. In fact, Orson Scott Card writes a lot of those themes into his science fiction where you have inevitable miscommunications. That's especially in the sequels to Ender's Game, including Speaker for the Dead, Xenocide, and Children of the Mind. I love those books. And a huge theme in that book is different cultures where you simply don't know something and you think that different culture are savage killers when they're in fact something else. So all this to say, this relates to, you know, the dawn of artificial intelligence, where even if it existed right now, we would just see it as noise, as just like bits and bytes and, you know, just noise. Like if Google were actually self-aware, we wouldn't know at this stage. So that's kind of a scary thought, but that's at least my thought here.
and there's even other stuff you get into, like, for example, like if humans are seen as neurons and the way that they talk to each other considered neural connections, we could consider the fact that no one has ever figured out a way to unlock a way to talk to the human consciousness as a whole. I mean, it'd be cool if we had made some kind of weird machine that used like principles of economics and propaganda and all these things to literally talk to the human subconscious, but that's getting into weird sci-fi.
Yes. You know, and in the series of articles that led up to part one of this episode, it was the IEEE Spectrum articles that I cited. One of the later articles was a review of the chatbot created by Microsoft that turned out to be extremely racist. The chatbot learned from people who interacted with it, and some people were rather unsavory and wrote very awful things, and the chatbot adapted that as part of its habits. So it is possible to have a wild, you know, a chatbot that is self-learning turn into what we consider awful and very, very racist. So
yeah, and it's like there's also a Facebook algorithm because of the way it was trained improperly because of unrecognized at first cultural biases. Mm-hmm. They were identifying Black people on Facebook as gorillas, even though it was an AI.
Yes.
And yep. It's like and then they fixed it and now it doesn't do that anymore. But yes, for a while it was doing that, and like, you know, it reminds me of there's a computer science cone. A cone is originally is this Buddhist kind of story that makes no sense that's supposed to lead you to enlightenment, and computer scientists made their own. Mm-hmm. But there's this cone that says that a computer science guru came to see a student, and the student was programming a neural network. His guru asks, what are you doing? The computer science student said, I'm making a neural network play tic-tac-toe. The guru said, how are you wiring it? The student said, randomly. The guru said, how come? The student said, so it'll have no preconception of how to play. The guru closed his eyes. The student said, why are you closing your eyes? The guru said, so the room will not exist.
Oh, interesting.
And just meditate on that and it'll make sense after a while.
Okay, yeah, let's just play some music while you meditate. Full disclosure, I said,
the hint,
oh, what?
They,
What's up?
The hint is that there's that basically, even when you try to be as impartial as possible, you are still somebody who's making something based. So there's always going to be a subjective component.
Yeah.
Like even the objective measures that you take are subjectively chosen.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, real quick, before I lose my train of thought here, the Rick and Morty episode that I'm talking about is called Close Encounters of the Rick Kind. It is from season 2. And in that episode, there are these mental parasites that create false memories in your mind. And the false memories are of somebody that never actually existed, but suddenly these artificial memories appear. And it seems as though they did. And it relies heavily on deeply sentimental memories of these individuals. So we would say that if those parasites existed in real life, it'd probably be involved with not only producing false imagery and other memories, but producing heavy hits of oxytocin. So there's a lot of sentiment behind it. In this episode, you know, we later find out, I may have a little spoiler here, but there's a way that you find out that these parasites that produce these memories, there's a way to tell what memories are real and which are false. I'm not going to spoil that part for you because that's a very good part of the episode. But this is all part of this. I am completely fooled by the people that don't exist on the website. This person does not exist. And this is just from visual inspection that makes me think about what other ways do I recognize dealing with a human and how could I be fooled that they exist? Similar to the Rick and Morty mental parasite example where there's oxytocin being pumped. Like, let's just say either an artificial intelligence or some alien life figured out how to do that, how to pump oxytocin and made us doped up on feel good feelings and you know, think that we're in a safe place and we could be taken advantage of then. It's the same kind of fear. Like, this is real. It's possible for us to be fooled, and that's a very, very scary thing. And then it just gets me thinking of other ways that humans can be fooled. We are not so perfect after all. It's terrifying.
There's a whole field of fooling human senses that sometimes is poorly paid attention to. But I mean, look at illusion and magic.
Yes, absolutely. I was
like,
yeah,
literally that's to fool human, and it's really simple.
Wow, this was a wonderful long tangent that I thought was great. I thought it was fantastic.
I know
that we were in the middle of LSTM. Is there more that we need to say about LSTM specifically and how and what it does that other traditional neural networks do not do?
Well, it's really good at producing sequences. That's the best thing about LSTMs. It's really good at producing sequences. It's also cool because it uses a rudimentary form of memory, which is its forget vector, mm-hmm. Because it knows what's important and what's not. But it's also been used to great effect with data compression. Basically, you train a model using the data that you want to compress. And I can't remember exactly how it works, but I mean, not only data compression, other stuff I've seen done with LSTMs is imitation of cursive handwriting. I've seen generating half handwriting of one type and half of another, because you can add these networks together sometimes. It's really cool what you can do with these.
Wow, that's fascinating.
All right, so now we're going to talk a little bit about Bayes' theorem and just Bayesian probability and stuff.
So yes, as Sophia was saying, the next section is on Bayesian networks, which obviously involves Bayes' theorem. So naturally, we'll be talking about Thomas Bayes, who originated the theorem, and how it is now used and how it is different than LSTM networks. There will be a test. Pay attention.
Yeah, and Thomas Bayes was kind of a contemporary of people what's his name? Ben Franklin and stuff. A little older than Ben Franklin. He was 1701 to 1761. But basically, his whole thing was that instead of probability being counted as something based on a frequency of it happening, it should be based on like this weird kind of like internal likelihood of it happening, which seems like a small difference, but basically it asks sometimes the question like, what is the probability of the null hypothesis compared to the alternative versus what is the total probability of the null hypothesis, which can be more useful sometimes, because sometimes even though like the null hypothesis might be a lot more likely than nothing, it might not be much more likely than the alternative.
Interesting. Yeah. So subtle, but useful differences. Now, the original Bayes' theorem, I think it was used to try to prove God or God's existence, I believe.
Was that Bayes' theorem or was that Pascal's
stuff? I think it was also Bayes. I'll prove it real quick. Let me do insert typing right, sound. Sweet. Check it out, yo. So from thank you to QZ.com. The most important formula in data science was first used to prove the existence of God. That is a June 30th article by Dan Kopf. How do you say his name? Correct. That's right. That's where it came from. Yep.
Interesting.
Yes.
But yeah, it's used now in like inferring probabilities because, I mean, we'll go through some identities. Basically, Bayes' theorem like sometimes it relies on the notation, the probability of A given B. So what does that mean? So let's say in our culture, for example, people who identify as men don't tend to wear skirts. People who identify as women wear skirts some of the time. So let's say 1 out of 5 women wear a skirt, but only 1 out of 100 men wear a skirt. That means that the probability of someone wearing a skirt, given the fact that they're a woman, is 1 out of 5. But the probability of someone wearing a skirt, given that they're a man, is 1 out of 100 or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so the first formulas we want to do is the probability of A given B is the probability of A and B happening, you know, both of them happening, divided by the probability of just B happening alone.
Interesting. Yeah, and then I can see this is where you can do all kinds of, you know, combinations. I don't say combinations, but from that, you can have a whole set of, what's the term I'm looking for? Not theorems.
Formulae?
Formulae, yes. Formulae all derived from that by itself. So basically, if B is assumed to already have happened, then it sort of amplifies the likelihood of the probability of A given B relative to the probability of A and B both happening. For example, if 1/3 of all days are rainy, half of all those days are...
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Parade days. And all rainy days are on parade days. Then that means that 2 out of every 6 days are rainy. And 3 of 6 days are parade days. Since all rainy days are on parade days, that means that we have 2 rainy days for each 3 parade days, if you guys are following along on that. That means that given the assumption that it was a parade day, the chance that it will be rainy is not 1/3, but 2/3, which is 1/3 divided by 1/2.
And that section is not totally necessary to understanding Bayes' theorem, like necessarily, but if you're interested in it, I would suggest listening to that a couple of times because, especially the way that Gabriel read it was very clear.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's just probabilities given other events. And, you know, that's again, a nuanced thing here, but obviously a very, very relevant thing to talk about.
Probability is all about assumptions of what you know, what you don't know. Because if you think about it, probability is all about what you don't know. Because if you did know it, there wouldn't be a probability associated with it.
Yes, and understanding the relationships between related events. For instance, you know, if I have peanut butter on my sandwich, what's the likelihood that I have jelly as well? Or rather, you could say, you know, you may want to revisit the likelihood that I have jelly given that I have peanut butter on my sandwich as opposed to anything else, you know?
Yeah, like if you put a piece of bread on the counter, maybe there's a 50% chance that the next thing you put on is turkey. Yes. Maybe 50% that is jelly.
Yes.
But once you put on jelly, there's almost 100% chance that it's going to be peanut butter, maybe a 5% chance that it's going to be bananas.
Correct.
But there's almost no chance it's going to be cheese.
Yes.
And
yes.
By the way, I thank our non-American listeners for putting up with that because Gabriel, did you know that outside of the United States, people don't eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches?
Y'all are missing out. You guys got to try it. It is delicious.
I know. Like, don't think of peanut butter as being a savory food. Just put some jelly on it and taste the magic.
It's American. We are experimental, you know, but we figure out some cool stuff. And we got a little visitor here. He's in my room. Hey, baby boy. What's up? Augie, do you like peanut butter? Do you like peanut butter, Augie? He'll be joining us here for a little bit for this last part of the episode. Yeah, it's my my little guy. For those of you who are listening elsewhere, it's very good. Just regular bread. Okay, well, what's considered regular elsewhere? You know what I mean? Like,
I would say just like a slice of wheat bread, the kind of bread that is long and square.
Yes, for morning toast. Just Google, go to, you know, whatever internet, you know, search tool you like and type peanut butter and jelly and try it. It will. So the thing about it is it's filling. It's very, very filling and it's sweet, you know?
Yeah, it's sweet and it's delicious, but not too sweet.
Yeah.
And what's nice about it too is that, it also just, I'm sure British listeners are fuming at the ears right now because jelly over there means jello over here. But peanut butter and jam, okay? We appreciate all our British listeners. But a Bayes theorem is cool because it relates the probability of A given B to the probability of B given A using only a probability of B and probability of A.
Wow.
And what it is the probability of A given B times the probability of B is equal to the probability of B given A given the probability of A.
Woo! And, that one's fun.
And yeah, it could be derived from the probability of AB is the probability of AB. You multiply that by the probability of A divided by the probability of A. And then you use the identity, the probability of AB divided by the probability of A is probability of B given A. But the probability of AB divided by the probability of B is probability of A given B.
Jeez.
But that's not that important. But basically, like, what this allows us to do is, for example, answer questions like how effective is a test for a virus? You know, like if it has a certain positive rate and a certain negative rate, how often does it actually detect the virus correctly? And sometimes the number is a lot lower than what we think it should be because of the way that the math works out. Because humans are bad at interpreting probability. And that's why I want humans to, I want humans to learn probability. I want it to be taught in preschools using games. Like we teach so many things using games like cooperation and things like that. Why not probability?
Mm-hmm. Hey, do you remember, what do you call those 17th and 18th century things where it was an automaton that would supposedly write?
Those are just called automatons.
Okay.
But yeah, they totally did write. There's some restored ones now. You can see YouTube videos of them.
So some of them can write, and I'm sure you're aware of the automaton fraud as well, where some of them, you know.
Oh, the Turkish, like the Turkish chess plane robot. So basically, there is this thing called the Mechanical Turk, and it was this stereotypical Turkish guy. It was the early 1800s or whatever, and it was some robot that was said to be able to play chess with any human, and it was extremely good at chess. It would defeat masters and stuff like that, and it turned out after a very long time that they had just gotten a chess grandmaster or master or whatever to agree to help him with this, it was somebody in the machine itself manipulating all kinds of knobs so it was half robot, half machine. It was like, and it would play chess based on all these weird signals. And it was a big hoax, but I would recommend reading about it. Mechanical Turk.
So in this day and age of deep fakes and neural networks, I'm sure that there are neural networks that also have human beings behind the curtain as well, making it seem just a little more real. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that's a thing, or rather that's at least part of it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that because what you've gotten into is the difference between a trained and an untrained network. And let me expand on what I mean by that. Basically, you train a network when you have a human telling it, like, yes, he did good. Yes, he did bad, neural network. But it's untrained supervised or unsupervised. But it's unsupervised when you use some mathematical criteria, some function to do that work for you. And there's hybrids, too, and stuff like that. For example, like the generative adversarial networks that we talked about earlier where they fight each other.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So that's also a thing, too. We also have a lot of human involvement as well. Interesting. Wow.
But yeah, so if you put a bunch of Bayesian variables together, if you think about P of B given A as being like an arrow from A to B, you can think of all these different associations that things have with each other, like what's related to what. And Judy Apearl, who was born in 1936, and he's still alive, he's an Israeli mathematician and computer scientist, and he popularized the idea of Bayesian networks. And let me give you a basic description. Let's suppose we could win the lottery, right? And that's a completely random event, right? It's not really based on anything. It's based on a draw. And let's say on the day that we can win the lottery, it might rain, and the ground might get wet from the rain versus just evaporating, you know, immediately like some rain does. Mm-hmm. So let's call these variables L for lottery, R for rain, and W from getting wet from the rain. W obviously depends on R, right? Because it can't get wet from the rain unless it's rainy to begin with. So those variables must, you know, relate, since they epistemologically relate.
Yes.
So the joint probability of R and W, that is rain, is that might get wet for the rain, is the probability of rain times the probability of it getting wet given that it's raining. So basically, you can combine variables like that if they're related. And since L is independent, we just multiply it by that. So the probability of L, R, and W altogether is the probability of R times the probability of L times the probability of W given R.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense.
So let's say that we want to figure out, like, you know, the probability. Let's say we have all these different variables, right? And we know how they relate to one another. Yes. But we want to know the probability of, like, you know, for example, like, let's say we have this gigantic network that it's raining. So basically, you combine variables like that if they're related. And since L is independent, we just multiply it by that. So the probability of L, R, and W altogether is the probability of R times the probability of L times the probability of W given R.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense.
So let's say that we want to figure out, like, you know, the probability. Let's say we have all these different variables, right? And we know how they relate to one another. Yes. But we want to know the probability of, like, you know, for example, like, let's say we have this gigantic network. The probability that we're going to buy red shoes, given the fact that we are just visited by a politician. Or something weird like that. We can figure that out by summing up all the probabilities of the variables that aren't R or S together. But the thing is, it takes a very long time. So let's say we have like 10 different variables, right?
Yeah.
2 to the 10th is 1,024. So let's say we had 20 different variables. 2 to the 20th is like a million. So the more variables you add, it gets very, very complex very quick.
Mm-hmm.
So we use the technique of variable elimination, which helps a lot. And you could see this on Wikipedia, or if you're a Patreon member of the $5 class or more, you could see our outline on this.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, we have to use estimation techniques in practicality, because except for small problems, the problem is NP complete, meaning that it uses approximately exponential time, non-polynomial time. And polynomial time is like, you know, 2 to the N. I mean, I'm not 2 to the N, like N to the X. So like, let's say the problem is like 3 times as big. So it takes like 3 cubed times as long, or 3 to the 20th times as long. Mm-hmm. Those are all polynomial. But as soon as it gets to like 2 to the 20th or 2 to the 30th or something like that, it's called NP complete, because it is no longer polynomial.
I see.
And it's part of a huge problem called P equals NP. But we've talked about that a little bit in past episodes, but we'll talk about that again in the future.
Okay. Yeah. So I know that with respect to applications, we talked a little bit about medical applications. I think that understanding probabilities in medicine, Bayesian statistics are huge, because they really help.
Automated diagnostics.
Yes.
For example, like given all these probabilities, like this person is presenting with this symptoms, they, you know, are this ethnicity, they weigh this much, they have this level of potassium in their blood. What is the probability that they have this disease? And how much can we reduce the uncertainty given these series of tests? Mm-hmm. So it really helps with, like, you know, things like that. I mean, even to help with things like paleontology, you know, like where to go look for things. And it's just different from neural networks, because Bayesian networks are used when we specifically have causal or probabilistic relationships. So in machine learning, obviously, it's a field that is experiencing a renaissance, and we could really call it a renaissance because there's this thing in the 80s called the AI winter, where our basically computers weren't at the degree that they needed to be to continue AI research. So people just got really depressed and stopped researching AI until like the mid 90s, really. And it didn't really get big until like the 2010s or so, or like that's when it really started taking off again. So we have a lot of new paradigms that will exist. Like LSTM models only date back to, I think, 2011 or 2012. So, and there's new models popping up all the time. So it is a fertile field. Like if you have a good idea for a type of neuron, implement it, write a paper about it, put it on archive.org. That is ARXIV.org. And you might get an academic career out of it.
That'd be really cool. Yeah. It's a great time to be doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, Alex, and we'll interview about this soon, possibly. I'm not going to promise anything, but we're thinking about it. Basically, Alex, who's been on episode 41, Reality is More Than Complex, about group theory and how it relates to physics, has made a chatbot based on some gleamings and that he's taken from computational geometry. So he's created a paradigm all of his own. And it just goes to show how fertile this field is. Because, I mean, Alex is a brilliant person, but he's only one person of a million brilliant people just like him. And I'm sure several listen to this show. So if you have the gumption, go do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this is the future. This is what is going to create the future of organizing, the future of data collection, the future of, I mean, honestly, you name it. This is the ground floor.
That's a good way of putting it. That's an exciting time.
It's an exciting time to be a person studying thought, because we seem to be getting closer and closer to a point where we understand not only what thought is, but how to manipulate it and design algorithms to potentially make it more efficient and useful. It is also an exciting time because there are many challenges to be solved. In the 21st century, we're going to face more problems due to the complexity of climate change, politics, environmental changes due to pollution and climate change, and even just organizing society in a way that benefits the most people while striving to be human in that most quintessential human way, learning everything possible about the world around oneself. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Gabriel.
And this has been Breaking Math. Cool. So yeah, visit us on facebook.com/breakingmathpodcast, Twitter, Breaking Math Pod, website, breakingmathpodcast.app. And anything else that you think to plug? Oh, our email.
breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.